episode 250.
The techs tend to be really ambitious about learning, very serious about it. I mean, they've traveled to some city, Las Vegas or Kansas City, wherever, for a big conference, and they mean business. And so I have to step it up a notch or two to make sure I don't bore them and I teach them something new, hopefully. That's a neat challenge, and I like the challenge.
Welcome, aftermarketers, to Remarkable Results Radio. Listen to learn just one thing from today's episode on your journey to remarkable results. Hey, aftermarketers, welcome to the Remarkable Results Radio podcast. This is Carm Capriotto, your host, with episode 250. And I'm with industry trainer and writer Dave Hobbs from Delphi in a must-listen episode. This episode is brought to you by Federal Mogul Motor Parts and Garage Gurus for serious technical training and support online, on site, and on demand. Garage Gurus is everything you need to know. Find out more at fmgarageGurus.com. Hey, big thank yous to my new Facebook friends, Jared Monroe, Michael Barbuto, and Butch Jobst. And fist bumps to my new LinkedIn connections, Jeff Griffin, Stephanie Levinge, and John Gates. Hey, it's great to have you on board and engaged with the quality content produced for you each week. How about you? Have you connected with the podcast? For all pertinent links, go to remarkableresults.biz/social. Hey, don't miss out on the lessons from the Town Hall Academy. It's like your own private networking tool. Lessons on trending topics that will give you that edge and present many ideas and insights for you. Go to the Academy Toolbox page on the website. Hey, I'm heading to Apex 2017 this fall with a podcast studio to record great interviews for you. I would hope to meet you. Apex has a great program for service professionals and technicians this year with management and technical courses. Make plans in fall 2017 to attend the largest gathering of aftermarket professionals. Now meet Dave Hobbs, lead technical trainer and program developer at Delphi. Now, if you're a perpetual student, you may have been in one of Dave's classes, read his articles, or seen him on Delphi or AVI training videos. You are in for a treat here. There is additional bio information and the episode talking points on the show notes page for Dave's interview at remarkableresults.biz/E250. Now, I met Dave at a few conferences and admired his presentation skills. He is a highly regarded and respected industry trainer, and I'm excited to bring you this up-close interview with him and to get a close-up perspective on where he got his start in the industry and what it takes to create a training seminar. We talk ATIS, ATIS calibration, his personal phobia, basic electricity, and that our technology is the carrot at the end of the stick to entice recruitment into our industry. And Dave also speaks to a few industry challenges that need to be overcome in order to keep our ATEX. Great insights from a legacy industry trainer. Now, listen to the interview with Delphi's Dave Hobbs. A warm welcome to Dave Hobbs, lead field tech trainer and developer at Delphi. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Carm. How's it going?
Fabulous. Wow, what a big title. You have got responsibility.
Yeah, the whole world's right on my shoulders. Not. I'm loving what I'm doing.
I know you do. I've heard you speak, and you are, first of all, you're dynamic, easy to listen to, very passionate about what you talk about. Everyone can tell you love it. But I'm curious about the word developer. What does that involve?
We have training courses that we have to update Delphi. It's not just things we build. It's things that we think technicians are going to want to learn about. So whether we are making a particular part for that particular car or not, we try to have some coverage of, Euros, domestic Asian vehicles, drivability, electronics, you name it, hybrid. And those courses are constantly updated as well as new courses written. In fact, I'm developing an ADAS course, Automated Driver Assist System course, which is new with a new technology. And updating some hybrid training. We use a lot of contract developers, and I work with them and supply them with information and scan tool captures and information from engineers, things like that to help things go and review the product before we send it to print and then go out and teach it in the field. That's the field trainer part. That's the part I love the best.
You're a busy guy. So, you know, people probably don't, well, maybe a lot of them do realize that, you know, you put a, you do an hour presentation. How many hours behind the scenes does it take to put that on?
It's about a 4-to-1 at least, and that's if the fruit is hanging low, you've got some stuff. I call it raw materials. You know, it's like your iron ore and your coal, and you make steel. So the raw materials be scan tool captures, photographs, maybe other verbiage you've written in the past, but it's been just kind of here and there, everywhere, scattered. You kind of pull together to whatever you're trying to make a point. And then a lot of it's brand new research where you got to go interview engineers and interview other techs and trainers and so forth and try to get a big picture of how the system works.
I can relate to that. Podcasting is very, very similar. How did you get your start in this industry?
Well, Hobbs Auto Electric in the 1970s. Just grew up, pushing a broom, putting parts on the shelf, graduated to oil changes and things like that, tune-ups, before I was probably 16. So that was 1976.
But that was Dad's business, right?
That was Dad's business. Exactly. Yep. Dad just passed a year ago, this last June. He was wrenching almost until the very end. Mom made him kind of give it up because he was getting Alzheimer's and she saw those signs and didn't want him, embarrassing himself or worse yet, a customer, being hurt from a car. So she said later, I didn't know this. She says, I was the bad guy. I made him get out. But he had a business behind his house for about 10, 12 years of his unofficial retirement from the business and had RV owners come in from all over the world, a country, I should say, for accessories and things in the auto electric realm, the recreational vehicles.
Auto electric. Is two words you put together that a lot of technicians today, electric.
Well, it's a lost art of the auto electric shops that did rebuilding for years and years. My dad was one. Now you just buy an alternator starter off the shelf. It's kind of like anything else. Rebuilding's kind of gone by the wayside, even engines to some degree.
But the beauty of the fact that you learned it got you to where you are today.
Yes. I look back over that, Carm, and I'm thinking all my contemporaries were gearheads in high school. They were doing, custom camshafts and things like that. I'm putting electronic ignition on in place the points of condensers in my car. So I was like the techno gearhead kind of guy, the nerd gearhead.
Pocket protector guy?
Pretty much. I loved it all.
See, I have to tell you, those geeks are controlling the world we live in today.
And they
you can look back and say, yeah, I was out in audiovisual in high school. What are you doing today? Oh, software engineer. Okay, so I guess you're telling me how my world works.
They have the last laugh. They do.
I can't help but always come up to a topic when I talk to a trainer about basic electric and how critical it is for technicians to get back to that class, review that class. And if they don't understand it, probably even into the future, it's going to be even a tougher road.
Oh, it is. And I try to tread lightly when I use the word basic with any topic, especially electrical, because there's so many technicians, they have to have, and I say they, three fingers pointing back at me, Carm, because I'm one. We have to have a degree of confidence. You can call it ego if you want. I mean, healthy ego, normal ego, to say, hey, whatever car comes in my bay, I can fix it. And in order to do that, you kind of hate to say, well, I need remedial or I need basic this or I need basic that. So I like to call it fundamental training. But electrical, the fundamentals of electrical are oftentimes evading a lot of technicians' grasp to really master it. And those who have mastered it, usually pretty humble, and they go, you know what? I'll sit in a basic class, call it whatever you want to. I'm sure I'll pick up a thing or two that I've forgotten or I never really learned correctly the first time. So that's kind of how I like to be when I attend anybody else's class, is thinking no matter how basic it is, I'm sure I'm going to learn something.
So what's the big blockage to fundamentals?
It's that ego thing, in my opinion.
It's not learning volts, ohms, and amps. It's not learning what the laws are.
As educators, I have to take some blame there too, because sometimes we get a little bit too egg-headed with, trying to be too brainy and talk about valence rings and electrons and neutrons. And Carm, I've never, ever, even visually pictured a neutron or electron or proton to fix a car. But I have used Ohm's law as the concept, especially the relationship to fix cars. So some of the brainiac stuff is needed and some of it's not. And if we put too much of that into training, we kind of lose the techs and they lose the, you know, their desire to sit there and they zone out.
I'm talking with Jonathan Jacquelli, a technical product specialist with Federal Mogul Motor Parts. So, Jonathan, how does a service professional get the guru on the go van to their shop?
There's a couple ways. We do what we call cold calls, where we go around and just visit shops based on geographics. And there's also times where we team up with outside sales reps from other parts distributors and visit the shops on that basis.
So I love this. You pull into a shop on a cold call, they see the van, and they're probably excited to see you.
Yeah. I've had a couple shops where they've actually have already heard of the gurus via Facebook or social media. So when I show up, they've already been signed up and taken online classes, and now that the van's there, it's really easy to book a lunch and learn.
So you're really an extension of the Garage Guru training centers.
Yes, absolutely.
So you're all done with your lunch and learn. You spend 45 minutes to an hour. Probably that's all you can really get from a busy, busy shop. What are the technicians saying about your shop visit?
Oh, they love it. They thank me, you know, every second I'm walking out the door and just can't wait for me to come back again.
Federal Mogul Motor Parts' Garage Gurus is your go-to source for the vehicle training, technology, and answers you need to keep your next job on track. On site, online, or on demand, the gurus are here to help keep your business and your career on the road to success. Visit fmgarageguru.com. You know, it's great to talk to a trainer in our industry because I know my listener wants to hear your opinion of you in front and them in the audience. When you see your student get it, is it a endorphin euphoria feeling that you're doing your job right?
Funny you'd say that. It's the exact same words I use. You know, when I talk to other trainers or just think about it myself, I mean, and we're junkies for that. That sound of that relay clicking to turn that headlight or that light bulb on in a tech's mind, we can just almost sense it or smell it or whatever, hear it. And it's like, yes, we're getting through. It's like, I guess, an athlete, you know, hits the ball, a home run or throws a touchdown. I mean, it's like I have accomplished my mission. They have got something.
Do you desire questions from your students?
Definitely. And a handicap for me is hearing. I have two hearing aids and even an iPhone app to control them. And I make sure I try to have it up as loud as possible to try to hear what they're saying. And if it's a big enough group, sometimes the question is going to help somebody else. So repeating it, little things like that. But yeah, I definitely endorse them. And I always try to remember to say there's no dumb questions. I may have a dumb look on my face, and I'll have to try to get back with them with an answer, but I don't have all the answers for sure. But I certainly do like the questions.
Do you get butterflies before you go on?
Yeah, a little bit, especially if it's a topic that's new or I haven't taught it for a while. And it's amazing how much you forget. Even with the normal, I got tested because my father had Alzheimer's, so my wife was a little worried, a few senior moments, so I got tested for that, and the doctor said, well, congratulations, you have great memory, especially for your age and so forth. And I go, all right, so things I forget, it's just because I'm 50-something. And that being said, I can sit and watch a video I did years ago, 10 years ago, and learn from it. And you would think, well, you did the video, you should know everything in it. No, I knew everything in it 10 years ago when I made it. I've slept since then. So it's just like anybody else, you know, a tech out there in the field, like, gee, what was it on this car that I used to see in my bay all the time in the 90s or the last decade? I can't remember now. It comes back to them, you know, as they go through it. So same boat.
Okay. You just said senior moments. See, I'm getting them too, Dave.
Yeah.
And so how many do you have to get in a day before you go get tested? Give me a number, please, real quick here.
Yeah. 100. You're okay.
All right. I'm fine then. I'm good. I'm good. Man, I just, what did I walk in this room for? Did it ever happen to you?
Yeah. All of the above. Yep. But I found out even when I was a young boy, I would do stuff like that. And my mom always used to say, Dave, you would forget your head if it wasn't attached to your shoulders. So I feel like, well, it must just be my personality type, kind of the absent-minded professor type of personality.
Hey, Dave, you have a phobia about anything?
You know, I don't know if it's a phobia, but it's certainly a weakness. I should be better at sales than I am, in my opinion. And the crazy thing is, I wish I could go back and sell and, you know, be a service advisor in my dad's shop again, because I've been teaching that topic in the recent last couple of years for Delphi, and I've enjoyed the heck out of it, and I'm kind of wanting to experiment and try it again. But actually going out, like, to sell our courses to some, you know, some of the OE customers and so forth that we have, it's still the butterflies you mentioned earlier. That's where I get butterflies, definitely.
Ask for the order, I hear, huh?
Yeah, we're asking for the order, exactly.
Okay, so technology. I was impressed last year at Apex as I went around in a tech roundtable. We went into the Delphi booth, and you were in your back room doing such a great demonstration. You were showing products and the insides of the LIDARs and the radars. Is that a big portion of what you're doing now?
Yes, it is. I've kind of been focusing more on the conferences and the shows, and not out there in the, you know, all over the country and normal field classes out there in the backs of the part houses and colleges and so forth, where we typically do our training. And I love that part because a couple of reasons. You get to see a lot of the same people over again. So it's not a stranger every night. You do see a lot, because the people that go to conferences, technicians, the people who are vendors and so forth, other trainers, you get to see them. So you're on the road. You don't see your family, but they kind of become your family, you know? And I see you all the time. So you're just like a cousin, you know, out there.
That's right.
Somebody with a familiar face to see. And the other reason is the techs tend to be really ambitious about learning, very serious about it. I mean, they've traveled to some city, Las Vegas or Kansas City, wherever, for a big conference, and they mean business. And so I have to step it up a notch or two to make sure I don't bore them, and I teach them something new, hopefully. That's a neat challenge, and I like the challenge.
The thing that I loved about what you are doing, what I saw you do in Detroit at the Connected Cars program, what I saw you do at Apex last year, was to show how the parts are working. I mean, I had a big takeaway, and it was, I think you were explaining that radar is becoming affordable today, and you, I think you may have shown some larger units from years ago, and they were overheating. These are some of my takeaways, and I was thinking, wow, Delphi is on such the cutting edge in I think you were talking about working with Volvo. And helping to create smarter, better, more efficient, smaller units. Tell me a little bit about how that evolution has happened.
Well, it's like anything else. I mean, it's like cell phones or computers. They get smaller and smaller, get more affordable. If you think about the first calculator, I think you and I are old enough to remember a Texas Instrument calculator that just did addition.
No, you're wrong. I watched my grandmother push buttons and pull a lever.
Yeah, I've seen that. My mother do that as well. Didn't know anybody used an abacus outside of grade school, but but yeah, micro-sizing is a way to go. I mean, it helps with fuel economy, helps with cost. So every evolution, and it goes back to the actual microchip. I've been very blessed to work at Delphi and the division of Delphi Electronics and Safety for years. Prior, it was called Delco Electronics out of Kokomo, Indiana. They have a wafer fab. So you get to see the microchips actually being produced by the thousands on a single, you know, wafer about the size of a 45 RPM record or a CD, something like that. And every evolution of the chip allows the machinery then that's going to produce the chips to get more advanced, to make the chips smaller and more concentration of components on the single chip. And that just makes the component it's going to be in ultimately with, you know, hundreds of other components and ICs that much smaller as well. So it's just as an evolution upon evolution upon evolution.
And is all of that evolution, has that really spurred ADAS and ultimately CAT 5, the autonomous car? And I guess because we know where we're headed, are engineering companies and companies like Delphi working very hard to make the items more affordable and smaller and better and faster?
Yes. I would say safety has been the biggest driving point on that. Not necessarily fuel economy or environmental reasons. Those are out there in a separate sidebar side of technology, but just simply the radars and the cameras and the LIDARs, they are definitely there for consumer safety, reducing accidents, giving more convenience. And I'd have to say, with all the distractions we have today with cell phones and other multimedia things on the car, we want all of our gadgets with us, probably more so even than we have at home sometimes, just to kill time, takes us their eyes off the road. And so not advocating that you substitute, you know, being a safe driver, you know, when you have these other assistants, but they do help somewhat offset, I think, some of the distractions that we have. As it keeps you in your lane, warns you of oncoming traffic, warns you of somebody in your blind spot. And some cars, just for styling reasons, have more blind spots than others. As you can probably attest, you drive a few rental cars.
Yeah, I have. Absolutely. Is it LIDAR or radar that's really going to make that next generation of technology work, or both of them combined?
Well, I've actually studied a little bit about LIDAR. I don't believe... I'm not 100% certain. It may be working on it at Delphi. But smart cameras and radars are the main things we're working on currently in current model production applications. And the problem with LIDAR right now, from what I've seen, if you can picture like the Google car, the autonomous Google car, or the Uber car, yeah, it's a spinning trash can. I kind of joked about that, I think, in that Detroit conference. It's like, well, hopefully it gets smaller and they'll just dress it into the bumper like they have the smaller radars. But right now, it's not exactly an attractive thing to have on top of your roof. But it sends out laser. That's what LIDAR is. It sends out laser. The laser bounces back just like police radar and laser. Police laser that, you know, detects your speed does the same thing. But does it so much, it actually can draw an image that looks a little bit like a crazy-looking photographic image. As opposed to, you know, you probably have seen some of the photographic images of different colors, almost looks like infrared or something from the smart camera. So they're doing a little bit of the same job. I believe Tesla is radar and smart camera, and other vehicles are using LIDAR, but they're the ones that are not really that concerned about aesthetics, like a normal production car, like the Uber and the Google car.
So if they don't get LIDAR down to some aesthetic component of the car, then you're going to be able to spot an autonomous car instantly because it's going to have that, if you will, 747 bubble on top, right?
Yep, yep. Or you'll actually see the spinning trash can.
You'll see the spinning trash can. I love it. So when you get out and start, you know, teaching, and it was a great seminar that you did in Detroit, and you really opened our eyes to lane departure, collision mitigation, side detection, intelligent view cameras. One of the things that I saw was I think it may have been you that said, if the passenger or the person on the side of the road isn't moving, the radar can't pick them up. Is that true?
It picks them up, but it sorts it out. Interesting you'd ask that, because just yesterday I'm in a brand new Ford Flex and I'm using an aftermarket scan tool to communicate with both sides one at a time on the CAN bus, the side radars, for blind spot monitoring. It didn't have lane assist, keep assist, but it had blind spot monitoring. And so I'm having my wife drive, and I'm riding, and I've got the laptop on my lap, and I'm looking at all these different signals that are being received as data PIDs, and there's like seven of them. So I graph them all, put them all up on a digital display, and then I graphed them all, and they're seeing everything. They were seeing, let's say, the little bridge abutment. You go past on an overpass and there's a cement wall with, say, 15, 20 feet from the side of your car. They were seeing that. So what the software does, this is like everything today. Software makes it happen. So you can micro-size all you want, but if you don't have smart people writing code, it's not going to work in the real world. So the software looks at the movement. You know, is that item a stationary item we're driving past? Or is it a semi? Because I actually looked at some patterns on my graphing software on the scanner, and we went and passed the semi, maybe 2 or 3 miles per hour faster than the semi on the passenger side. That was the one I was monitoring with my scan tool. And sure enough, there's this really long up, you know, for distance, and then back down, like a little square wave that shows the length of the semi past a car, much shorter. And so it can see these things coming in on the radar, but the software's got to be smart enough to say, now, is that a motorcycle that came in to the radar's beam? They're called beams, beams 1 through 7 on the data pits. Or is that, you know, we just drove past a fence post or a road sign? So there's a lot of things that the radar has to sort out with software. And that's the part I really admire the engineers for being able to figure that out.
Millions and millions and millions of lines of code is really what you're telling me, because as it's interpreting these 7 beams, it has to have such a level of processing power to say, I recognize this waveform, and it is this, and to attempt to get it right.
And there's a lot of trial and error, I'm sure. A lot of modeling, a lot of software modeling. And then I've actually seen the guys do this at our plant. I've seen them out in the parking lot, literally, walking in front of a vehicle. I go, hey, Bob, careful. Oh, you're doing that on purpose. No problem.
Is it because they're trying to teach they're trying to develop the code that recognizes what a walking person at 20 feet away is?
Mainly validating the code that they, you know, model in the lab and tweaking it.
Validating. Instead of learning, they're validating what they've already done.
And where we are as technicians is like the early years of OBD-1 in this little world. Like when 1981 came around and nobody really knew what block, learn, and integrator were supposed to be on that General Motors vehicle, on that little old slow-moving scan tool at a baud rate of 160. We didn't know, but we just kind of looked at cars that were okay, running good, and we had ideas, and then we'd see cars that were running rich or lean, and you know, we'd say, okay, this is what the numbers are doing. And then finally, it'd be a training class that would be set up, and we could reaffirm what we knew. It's going to be the same thing with ADAS. I think it's actually as big of a technological jump for techs as hybrids was.
So it's a perfect segue into asking you about technicians keeping up. Is it too early to attend one of your new ADAS classes?
No, not at all. When you consider adaptive cruise control has been around for way over 10 years, 15 years. Jaguars and, you know, Lincoln's Cadillacs and so forth have had them for years. And that it's very commonplace to see the blind spot monitors now. And they're coming out of warranty. You know, somebody drives a lot, they got 36,000 or whatever the bumper-to-bumper warranty is. This would not be a long extended emissions warranty or like a hybrid battery pack warranty, which is well past the normal bumper-to-bumper warranty. So you get whatever that is for that OEM, let's just say 3 and 36, you can get that pretty quick on, let's say, somebody who's a road warrior, a salesperson or whatever that uses that car. And so now, not only the dealers have had to learn about it and the body shops from day one, now the average tech and the mom-pop repair shop, like I came from, they're having to bone up on it as well. And although I don't think it's going to break down near as much as, say, a mechanical EGR valve or things that are just, you know, prone to wear out or get clogged up from, you know, the particulates of the engine, these things will get hit. There'll be bumper replacements, windshield replacements, lightning strikes, reverse polarities, and just go bad. And I talked to a technician on one particular OE just last week at Automechanica. I did a little shorter version of what you saw up in Detroit. And he came up to me and he said that he'd seen several of these cameras. And I don't think it's ours. I think it might be a competitor's. But regardless, he said they were getting hot. And they were physically hot enough to burn his fingers. He was replacing them. So it's like, wow, that's interesting. You know, it might be a design flaw or an issue with sun load. Who knows? I know there's a TSB for that on some models. But yeah, I think it will break more than we probably think right now, and we'll got to be ready for it.
And so are your classes going to be more on awareness or awareness and repair?
Both. I think I'm doing an injustice if I just go out and talk about theory of something that's out there. I need to give them some quick and dirty things to try. I mean, obviously, you can pull codes. You can follow flowcharts. But all techs listening to this podcast right now, you'll attest that you've had many occasions where the flowchart didn't exactly lead you in an expedient manner to an accurate resolution. So you had to use some good old-fashioned theory and signal knowledge as far as, you know, using your meter, using your scope. And that's what I've been trying to help with development, like looking at some of the composite video signals for backup cameras and trying to determine the best I can with CAN bus messages or flex ray or whatever that particular radar, LIDAR, or camera's using, what kind of signals that we see with a scope, just to help out the tech supplementing the flow charts.
So talk to me about calibration.
Oh, man. This is not going to be an easy task right now. I just responded to somebody, this guy at Snap-on. He was in the thing in Detroit with you and I, and he asked about the standardization of calibrating these cameras and radars. And I said, I don't think the industry learned its lesson from the hybrid service disconnect plugs, where there's like 8 different styles and they're all in different locations. I mean, and you have like within Prius Gen 1, 2, 3, and 4 now, and they're all differently located. They may have used the same shape most of the time through the Prius, except for Gen 1. But even with that one line, it's all over the board. You have the Ford, looks like the gas cap, and I think they brought that back on a model. I don't even think it's a Ford, some other model. So it's just crazy. A lot more standardization with the EVs and the plug connector for recharging than there is with the safety disconnects. So we didn't learn from that point I'm making. And we certainly, it looks like we've not learned that and applied any lessons learned on commonization for target acquisition and calibrating. So as you probably step out of the parking lot up there in Detroit at the Connected Cars Conference, and my colleague from Bosch, Steve Zack, set up that new tool that they have developed for basically, as we're currently counting, Steve said, like, I think 15 different types of setups and targeting. And so this universal kit had to have all the different physical targets, like you'd aim a movie studio camera at to focus it, and different distances and different heights and other issues that are part of the static calibration prior to dynamic calibration.
With all of that said, a few of us were hanging around after that incredible demonstration of calibration in the rain, actually, and it was such an interesting thing to watch. A few of us went to dinner that night and said, you know what's going to happen. You know, it'll take 5 years and they'll figure out how to automatically calibrate these units. Do you actually think that could be Star Wars or true?
I mean, that's possible. I mean, look at, who would have thought that steering angle sensors would not need to have something done to them? But as we've made wheel speed sensors, in my theory, made wheel speed sensors a lot more accurate with the active square wave producing sensors, we can determine exactly where each wheel is, how fast it's turning, and that gives us the deadhead. We're going straight now. And so whatever that SAS, steering angle sensor, is saying, that's zero. So that's how they're calibrating themselves. And I don't know why some bright engineer couldn't do a similar thing to simplify, years down the road, calibrating the radars and cameras and LIDARs as well.
Okay. Well, thank you for supporting our little dinner talk. Just, you know, look at the stuff we have today and how seamless it works. And there's so much going on under the covers that we really don't respect those geeks that wrote the code and did everything to make our lives easier. You almost think that, you know, we were actually talking, well, this could be a cottage industry of someone going around like a mobile tech and doing the calibrations, but you have to have a perfectly level place. It can't be too light or dark. And you know, it was amazing to look at all the conditions that were necessary to get a good calibration.
Yes. One thing I see with the next step beyond the static calibration with the equipment, the targets and so forth, the dynamic calibration, the part where you do the road test. Most of them have a part two. So once you get it close, then you go to the part two and you're driving, and it's like certain speeds can have snow or rain or ice, too much of that. Can be bumper to bumper, can be going under 35, over 55. blah, 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 and a target-rich area. It can't be some boring desert road with nothing along the road. And interesting enough, yesterday when I was driving one of these vehicles, I'm thinking, wow, I can tell by looking at those radar beams if I'm on a target-rich road or not. I mean, I might think it's target-rich, go, yeah, there's some trees, there's some fence posts, but does the radar think it's target-rich? Target-rich zone almost sounds like an Air Force bombing term. Target-rich area.
A voice when you're doing this, a voice will come on in the car and say, "Find me a target-rich area." So, look at. I guess I can't let you go until I ask you about the quote-unquote technician shortage. You know, you're in front of so many Class A type. You know, really good A-techs. And, you know, and if not, you're in front of C-techs who want to become B's and A's, and that's exciting for our industry. Many people come up to you and talk to you about, owners come up and say, "Hey, Dave, where can I find a good A-tech?"
You know, I actually have more people ask me, "Where can I find a trainer?" Right? Because the A-techs are going to be more local. Although I have seen, as of lately, tech's becoming more mobile and actually moving. Like in maybe corporate America, you know, you're in Albuquerque working for a couple, 3 years. Now you move over to Portland, Oregon. You work there in some engineering job or administrative job, whatever. I've seen some techs starting to be more mobile, and they're getting recruited by some, you know, trophy shops. I'll call them nice, well-heeled shops that are well-equipped and can give the tech what they deserve, you know, as far as pay. And also, I think sometimes just the satisfaction working with good people, working with maybe a good clientele and having great equipment, that lures them away as much sometimes as the money. So I'm seeing a little bit of that, but mostly it's local. So, you know, since I'm from Kokomo, Indiana, you might ask me about, you know, any good techs here in your town, but typically, unless the tech really sticks out of my mind, I may not be able to pull. I can think of a face and a good question to somebody, you know, in Kansas City or somebody in Augusta, Georgia asked me 2 months ago, but I necessarily can't think of their name to say, "Oh, I know this, the guy you want to see if he's available to jump ship and work in your shop." So, but I am very passionate about trying to join in with some initiatives like Mike Rowe, kind of a hero of mine on television, you know, with trying to get people interested in the blue collar skilled trades. And we have been doing the same dumb things. We as parents, starts with us, you know, scolding our kids. "You don't want to do anything with your hands, you know, be a plumber, electrician, mechanic, anything like that. You want to be, you know, get a liberal arts degree and, you know, work in business management or anthropology, whatever." And you can only use so many of those people. Somebody actually has to build and repair the things that we all enjoy. And those jobs are in demand. They pay good if you have an aptitude for it. You might actually have a passion and enjoy it, whatever it is. In our case, you know, the automobile world. Just trying to encourage them. And then, you know, I see the same discouragement from guidance counselors. "Oh, Johnny or Mary, she's way too academically gifted to be back there in that vocational program, working in the shop, welding or working on cars or whatever. We need to make sure that they are going to, you know, all the college prep courses." I experienced that 40 years ago, and it's still going on today. I have friends in secondary education, and they're moaning about the same things that was present and going on 40 years ago. So we still haven't got through to the parents and guidance counselors and other school administrators that these are honorable and in demand and high paying jobs. You need to encourage young people that have an aptitude for it, not discourage them.
So you would recommend that everyone listening to this get into a high school, get into a school board, join an advisory council, and get the word out.
Yes, sir. Pour back into your industry. It's going to help you in the long run. You're going to need people working on your car at the very least. If you're not a shop owner, if you're a shop owner, you're going to need talent down the road when, you know, so-and-so retires or you just want to hand the business on to somebody else. I hear this comment a lot, way too much. "If my kid ever picks up a wrench, I'll break their arm." And I like, oh my gosh, you hate it that bad. You don't want to see this on your family. my dad never was like that. And I've kind of been modeled after. I know the industry has got its problems. We don't pay near well enough. We don't get benefits near high enough. And we shouldn't be making all these young people go into debt of 40, 50, 60 grand with the tool man that pulls up in front of the shop every week just to buy all these tools. It doesn't happen in other countries. Why is it happening here? I mean, the flat rate system is a very flawed system. A lot of shops and some dealers have given up on it and went to salaried if they trust, you know, the person's expertise working for them. But it's definitely a setup for failure, in my opinion, the flat rate industry. And that's another discouragement for people wanting to stay in the business.
Thank you so much for that real gut, you know, feel in how you look at things in our industry. That was just great. The future's bright, huh?
I think it still is. The technology, to me, is the carrot at the end of the stick. I try to encourage both shop owners and techs alike. When you get bogged down with all the Dilbert World BS, with all the expensive tools you got to buy, with the crazy fasteners and 15 different ways to calibrate a daggone sensor and all those things, step away from it for a while, you know, of an evening or a weekend. And whatever it is that was a big thing that floated your boat when you first got into the career, whether it's 40 years ago or 4 years ago or 4 months ago, go back to that. If it's a street rod you're building, if you're racing motorcycles, you know, if you love car shows, whatever it is that pulled you in, go back to your first love. And you'll get a little refresher, a little renewal, and you'll be able to go back into the real world of fixing these modern cars and diagnosing stubborn problems. It'll make things go a lot easier. Just keep falling in love with that industry, and it'll keep treating you right.
Well, great wise words. Dave Hobbs, lead field tech trainer and developer at Delphi. Thanks for being on.
Thank you, Carm.
Hey, aftermarketers, thanks for joining Delphi's Dave Hobbs and myself for this informative and insightful interview. I love Dave's easy and conversational ways. He sure knows how to get his message across. Get the top episode takeaways on the show notes page and additional bio information on Dave Hobbs at remarkableresults.biz/E250. I'm always grateful to trainers like Dave that share their story and view of the industry. Hey, don't forget how easy it is to listen to the podcast. It may be on your favorite podcast subscription service or simply with my free app available on Android or iOS platforms. Search in your app store for Remarkable Results Radio and install it. Within minutes, all the episodes will be right there at your fingertips. Hey, thanks for your support, and I hope you enjoy the powerful content library of the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. I'm grateful and thankful for your support.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.